Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Daughter Detox, Recovering from an Unloving Mother and Reclaiming Your Life by Peg Streep. Narrated by Callie Bollier. Introduction. Every week I get messages from women, left as comments on my blog posts, on my Facebook page, and in email that say the same thing. I always thought I was the only one with a mother who didn't love her. I feel better knowing that I'm not alone. They usually add, I'm so relieved to discover that I'm not crazy or imagining that this happened. You have no idea how long I've worried. Actually, I do. I was an unloved daughter myself. These women are all ages, from early 30s to mid-80s, and from all walks of life. They are stay-at-home moms, cashiers, doctors, hairdressers, lawyers, professors, secretaries, salespeople, and even therapists. In almost every case, their outward achievements belie how they really feel about themselves. They are still made unhappy by their childhoods despite the work they do and the families they've raised. They are women who have become devoted mothers, but who are still hobbled and hurt. They are women who recognize that they've never reached their full potential, who have hurtled from one relationship disaster to another, unable to get off the merry-go-round. Some have had children, while others deliberately chose not to, afraid of repeating history. Some have battled depression, disordered eating, or addictive behaviors, and are only now beginning to see how their behaviors connect to their childhoods. They are women who still want their mother's love and struggle with setting boundaries, wanting to attend family celebrations but still needing to protect themselves. They are women who have chosen to divorce their mothers, opting for peace along with self-orphaning over the status quo. If you are hearing these words, you are most likely one of these daughters, and no, you are not alone. In fact, you have more company than either you or I would ever have imagined. You believed, and perhaps still believe, as did my younger self, that you were to blame for your mommy's not loving you. You were afraid, just as I was for many years, to tell anyone, because you wanted to be like all the other daughters, the ones who were hugged by their mothers and whose moms smiled when they came into the room. You discovered, when you did confide, that people thought you were being dramatic because your mom seemed perfectly nice to them, and you were fed and clothed, weren't you? You were probably hopeful, and you might even be now, that somehow you'd still get your mother to love you. Somehow, maybe tomorrow, or the next day, or the next. Ours is a story no one wants to hear. Everyone wants desperately to believe that, in a world where love is so hard to find, and even harder to hang on to, one kind of love is inviolable, a mother's love. The truth of the unloving mother who actively wounds, dismisses, or disparages her child in words and actions is a cultural secret no one wants to acknowledge. We suffer alone and in silence in a sea of pastel-tinted sentiments plastered on T-shirts and mugs that say, "Home is where Mom is," and "World's Best Mom." Over the last few years, I've come to see that the sense of isolation, of being singled out in this way, of being labeled as damaged or less than, of being afraid that there is something terribly wrong with you, is just as wounding as the lack of mother love itself. The hole left in our hearts fills with shame, self-doubt, and sometimes self-loathing, but the discovery that there are others like us, that this is actually a shared experience for countless numbers of girls and women, is liberating. Daughter Detox offers a route to the way out. That's why I wrote this book. It's filled with stories told to me over the years by daughters whose experiences, while they differ in the details, hurt and change them just as ours did. But even more important, Daughter Detox lays out strategies drawn from science to get out from under the influence of the past so that you can finally become you, not just your mother's daughter. I've written it so that you can come to recognize and understand your childhood experiences, see how they have shaped the person you are in the moment, and take action to help yourself heal and grow into the very best version of yourself. It's the book I wish I'd had when my mother's voice still played on an endless tape loop in my head. I'm sure you, too, have struggled with that tape. The one that says you're inadequate, unlovable, stupid, difficult, worthless, fat, or any other variation on the theme. This book will help you understand the process that internalized that voice and help you locate an off button once and for all, and, more important, find another tape, one composed by you, to play. How to use this book. Each chapter of Daughter Detox focuses on a step-by-step process to guide you through the 7 stages of reclaiming your life and recovering from childhood. The process includes expanding your understanding of the circumstances of your life, hearing stories shared by other daughters, and then using strategies and techniques that are meant to help you move forward. You are working on undoing damage done over the course of many years, so you may find yourself needing to go back to a previous chapter, even if you've already heard it. That's to be expected. Recovery isn't a linear process. Because I'm neither a therapist nor a psychologist, I've drawn on strategies suggested by psychological and other research and, in some cases, steps that have worked for me as an unloved daughter who had to reclaim herself. This book isn't a substitute for therapy, of course, since nothing works quite as well or effectively as one-on-one work with a gifted counselor. Here are the 7 steps and what each of them entails. Journaling exercises for helping you heal organized by chapter and stage can be found in Chapter 10. Discovery. For many daughters, though not all, the first problem is recognizing the mother wound. There are many reasons, some complicated, some simple, that understanding the connection between the pain and unhappiness you feel and your mother's treatment of you is very hard for many daughters. Even for those who recognize at a young age that their mothers don't love them as a mother should, I was one of them, the full understanding of what this means and how it shapes you in every meaningful way is a slow revelation. The first 2 chapters of the book are devoted to discovery. Discernment. Understanding the relational patterns in your family of origin is the goal of this next step. Recognizing how the other people in your early and later life contributed or detracted from your mother's treatment of you is part of your growth. This includes how your father behaved and the attitudes of siblings and other people who formed a part of your childhood world. This step moves past discovery into the path of fully understanding the emotional connections you were exposed to and how they shape your personality, your view of yourself, and your thoughts and emotions. Teasing out how your own behaviors were formed in response to your treatment by your mother and others is the second stage of discernment. Figuring out your own patterns of attachment, whether you are anxious or avoidant, is part of this step, as are beginning to recognize triggers and starting to work on coping mechanisms to thwart them. Chapters 3 and 4 focus on discernment. Distinguish. You're not in your childhood room anymore, but the chances are good that you are bringing the relational patterns of the past into the present, and not just with your mother. Getting to the root of your own unhappiness in the present, whether that's an inability to maintain friendships or intimate connections, a sense of isolation, being unable to connect to anyone, constantly fighting with someone you know you love, or a series of relationships that make you feel marginalized or less than, is part of being able to distinguish older patterns, which are covered in Chapter 5. Disarm. This is the heart of Daughter Detox. Figuring out how not to be the little girl in your childhood home. All of the previous steps lead to this path, but it isn't a slam dunk. Why? It is about both her and you. And you have to bring the unconscious patterns in your behavior, formed in response to your mother's behaviors, into conscious awareness. specific strategies to deal with ruminative patterns of thought, recognizing emotional triggers, learning to identify and process emotions more productively, and more are the focus of Chapter 6. Reclaim. This step tackles how to go about changing your thinking and reactions so that you can move on to a new phase of your life. Learning how to harness your motivation so that you can achieve new goals, practical steps for achieving earned secure attachment, and using techniques that help you to reframe your thoughts to stay on track are all part of Chapter 7. Redirect. One of the key decisions you'll make as you move forward is redefining your relationship to your mother and most probably other members of your original family. Chapter 8 specifically focuses on helping you decide whether or not you should or can continue to be in contact or not. It details the pros and cons of continuing the relationship and what obstacles and barriers you're likely to face as you put boundaries in place. The decision to go no contact, its perils and rewards, is also explored in depth. One of the main goals of the redirect step is to enhance your ability to feel self-compassion and, indeed, to mother yourself. Recover. The final stage involves seeing the healing process as one that is ongoing and that really incorporating self-acceptance and self-compassion into your life remains a daily task. Using the Japanese art of kintsugi as its primary metaphor, this step requires you to understand healing in a different way and to make peace with the pace of the process. Chapter 10 is devoted to exercises key to each of the stages of a recovery. You can do them after listening to each chapter or at any other time. About the exercises in Daughter Detox. Most of the work involved in reclaiming your life from the effects of a toxic childhood is about bringing unconscious patterns of thinking and feeling to the surface so that they can be changed through consciousness. It's all about connecting the dots. A great deal of research attests to the fact that much of what we think is, in fact, not governed by rational and conscious deliberation, but by automatic, unconscious thought processes that the brain uses as shortcuts. To use psychologist Daniel Kahneman's terms, slow thinking versus fast thinking. Thought processes are also affected by what are called primes in the environment, as research by John A. Barge and Tanya L. Chartrand showed. So the environment in which you do these exercises, including journaling, matters. Choose a place to sit that makes you feel calm and focused. If a pile of unpaid bills or a sink full of dirty dishes is part of your visual landscape, you're not going to be fully focused. Being in a well-lit space is important. Carve out enough time to do the exercises without interruption. If you are in therapy, do not do these exercises without discussing them with your counselor first. Journaling. Research by James Pennebaker and others has shown that writing helps us not just to make sense of our experiences, but also permits us to create a coherent narrative of them. Creating a coherent narrative, connecting the dots between cause and effect, is an important part of healing from a toxic, abusive, or chaotic childhood. Writing has been shown to be a therapeutic tool provided you follow some simple rules. Pick a notebook or a blank book for journaling rather than using single sheets of paper. You should write by hand rather than using a tablet or computer because writing longhand uses a different brain circuitry. There's scientific research, too, that shows we remember and think more clearly when we write by hand rather than type. Remember that this isn't a test, and if writing makes you anxious, start by writing down phrases or words instead of full sentences. What to do when you are journaling and what to avoid. When you are writing about the past, make sure you are recalling why you felt as you did, not what you felt. Focusing on why you felt as you did is done best by recalling an event or experience as if from a great distance or as if it happened to someone else. This is called cool processing. The problem with remembering what you felt, which is called hot processing, is that if the feelings are vivid enough, they can actually put you emotionally back in the moment, act as a trigger for rumination, and effectively set you back a step or two. If you find yourself hot processing, remembering the pain you felt as a child when your mother taunted you or ignored you, or recalling a moment when you felt hopelessly alone and adrift, stop writing immediately. You need to be able to recall in a cool way. The first stop is discovery. It's the first baby step in the direction of understanding and, ultimately, healing. Chapter 1. The Truth About Maternal Power. I've spent the last 25 years trying to get my mother's voice out of my head. The voice that tells me it's just a matter of time until everyone realizes I'm not who I seem. The tape still plays when I get anxious, but most days I can muddle through and ignore it. Alexis, 40. The baby girl, just 1 month past her first birthday, is perched on the long plexiglass table, her hands and chubby knees touching its cool, smooth surface. She's round-faced and smiling at her mother, who's on the other side out of reach. Even though she's not walking yet, this baby in her pink coveralls is a confident crawler. She's calm and more curious than anything else about her unfamiliar surroundings. The plexiglass she's on is part of a very famous experiment called the Visual Cliff, originally designed and conceived of by scientist Eleanor Gibson to test whether depth perception was innate or learned. The idea came to this mother of two as her young children played near the edge of the Grand Canyon on a family vacation while she fretted about their safety. In the experiment, a checkerboard pattern lies flush under the plexiglass for half of its length, but then the fabric slants some 4 feet, creating the illusion of a sheer drop beneath the solid surface. Gibson and her colleague Richard Walker tested rats, kittens, puppies, and baby goats, as well as human infants, and discovered that once an animal or infant was old enough to locomote, depth perception had kicked in, causing them to screech to a halt at the sight of the drop. Babies crawled readily across the shallow end, but only a very few dared to take on the deep end. Even when there was a toy placed at the end to lure them, babies typically stopped their crawling at the point of the illusion of a drop-off. James Source and his colleagues took the cliff experiment one step further, exploring what a one-year-old does when her eyes are telling her one thing, yikes, there's a drop ahead, while her palms and knees, solid against the plastic, are telling her another. When her sensory perceptions contradict each other, how does she resolve the ambiguity? She looks to her mother for guidance. The researchers had the baby's mother stand on the deep end and assume various facial expressions. It's in this experiment, among others, that the extent of maternal power becomes crystalline. When the researchers had the mothers look happy and smiling, they discovered that an astonishing 74% of the babies began crawling and kept going, even over the deep end. The signals conveyed by their cheery mother's faces, all is well, you're safe, caused the babies to ignore the danger of a drop ahead that their own senses registered. In contrast, an angry face from their mothers on the other side was enough to stop every baby in his or her tracks. Some babies actually retreated, crawling backward at the sight of their mother's disapproving expressions. What's extraordinary about the results of the visual cliff isn't just that one-year-olds seek out and react to the emotions their mothers express, but that they rely on them sufficiently to override their own sensory perceptions about what is safe and what is dangerous. That's called total trust. After all, the baby doesn't know the drop isn't real. This and other experiments revealed that an infant is hardwired to use her mother's expressions, tones of voice, and behaviors as her lodestar for navigating life long before she understands words or the complexity of the world. It's a process that appears to begin even before birth. One study showed that the heart rates of near-term babies in utero increased when tapes of their mothers reading poems were played and slowed when they were played a tape of a stranger's voice. Babies are born recognizing their mother's voices, can distinguish them from other female voices, and can identify their mothers by smell. Infants as young as 5 days old undergoing a neonatal heel pin prick can even derive comfort from smelling the scent of their mother's breast milk. They have been shown to self-soothe faster and cry less than babies exposed to the scent of a stranger's breast milk or formula undergoing the same pin prick. Another experiment showed that a mother's voice calmed and stopped agitated motor movements in babies 1 to 4 days old. Because it takes a human infant so long to reach maturity and take care of herself, compared to a newt or duckling or fawn, say, evolution has assured that she is exquisitely sensitive to her mother, adept at reading her cues in the most subtle ways. That is not, as we'll see, always a bonus, since evolutionary adaptation is focused on aiding survival in times of stress, not necessarily on fostering psychological well-being. Adaptation, it turns out, is a yin-yang thing. Notably, there's no parallel evolutionary development of responsiveness in human mothers. There's only the reproductive equipment to bear a child and produce breast milk, a mix of hormones, but not an innate ability to nurture or love. In truth, elephants are more instinctually suited to mother well than humans. This is perhaps unnerving news for most people who like to believe that being a good mother is something that comes naturally and automatically. In fact, some infant and toddler behaviors appear to have evolved with the absence of hardwiring of mother's love taken into account. To make sure that mothers don't forget their babies, either in the fields during hunter-gatherer times or at the mall or in a car seat today, the infant's cry is pitched in such a way to get the attention of the adult brain. That's why you can't sleep through that baby's wail on a crowded plane, even though it's not yours, and you may not even be a parent. A study by Katie Young and Christine Parsons showed that the more primitive parts of the brain were activated by the sound of an infant's cry within 100 milliseconds. Yes, that's 1/10 of a second. Basically, that means that your brain is on high alert before you've even consciously registered the cry. And if you're wondering, none of that happens when adults sob, dogs bark, or cats meow. And it gets even more interesting. Consider whining, for example. Why whine? Scientists asked. Why not grunt or wheeze or yell? Like that high-pitched infant cry, the pitch and modulation of the whine are much more effective than other sounds in terms of intruding into and penetrating a mother's consciousness. In fact, the whine, as shown in a study by Rosemarie Sokol Chang and Nicholas S. Thompson, was the most effective way of distracting participants so that they couldn't even perform the simplest of subtraction tasks. So babies are not just hardwired to need their mother's attention and love, but also come equipped with behaviors that make it hard for their mothers to ignore them. You can think of infants as heat-seeking missiles in search of love, protection, and attunement. This is why, if your connection to your mother has been fraught, difficult, or downright damaging, a very big part of you still wants and needs her love, no matter what. There doesn't appear to be an expiration date on that need either. More than half of the time, children get what they need to thrive and to explore the world with a reliable person, their mother, as a safe home base. This is called secure attachment, a psychological construct first proposed by John Bowlby and later expanded by his student Mary Ainsworth. It was Ainsworth's experiment, The Strange Situation, that shed new light on the mother's power and influence and her ability to shape how her child connected to the world at large, not just in childhood, but also throughout life. Appreciating the strange situation. Ainsworth's line of inquiry went beyond the automatic responses supplied by evolutionary hardwiring and looked at how the infant's experiences with her mother shaped her innate responses. What she discovered would revolutionize not just the understanding of the extraordinary and lasting influence a mother has on her offspring, but would also shine a bright light on why some individuals are able to forge close and sustaining emotional connections, and others aren't. The strange situation was a series of staged encounters, beginning with the mother and child coming into the unfamiliar lab room. The mother would sit back as the child played and explored the room. Then a stranger would enter, speak to the mother, and approach the infant. While the baby was distracted, the mother would leave the room. The child would realize her mother was gone, and the stranger would interact with the child. Afterward, the mother would return and comfort the child while the stranger left. The mother would again exit, and the child would be alone in the room. The stranger would enter and respond to the child. Finally, the mother would return, pick up the infant, and the stranger would exit inconspicuously. Ainsworth hypothesized that, deprived of her mother, the child would go through reliable stages of response, that her mother's presence would make her feel safe enough to explore an unfamiliar place, that distress and protest would be the response to her mother's disappearance, that she'd show predictable wariness of the stranger when she was alone with her, and that she'd be calmed by her mother's return. And that's precisely what happened with more than half of the babies. But significant numbers of children, more than 30 to 40% of them, behaved in ways that were highly unexpected. Some of the babies derived no comfort from their mother's presence in the unfamiliar room and didn't try to explore. Some didn't react when left alone with the stranger and displayed little affect when their mothers returned. Others showed distress when their mothers left, but then either ignored their mothers when they came back or actively pushed them away. Still others cried and fussed even after their mother came back, wailing as they clung to her. What made the quality of these connections so different? What, if anything, had taken place between mother and child in the past so that the behaviors typical of these securely attached were supplanted by other patterns? What happens when a baby doesn't get what she needs? If you're listening to this book because you are an unloved daughter, and the odds are good that you believe you are, you already have emotional knowledge of what not getting what you need from your mother feels like. But few of us understand the full impact an unloving mother has. To recover from the wounds of childhood, we have to be able to see them first. To start, let's look at the science that explains, in part, how you were affected by your experiences in infancy and early childhood. Naming the problem. I spent my childhood and most of my early adulthood trying to get my mother's attention. I was an only child, but you can forget that coddled, fussed-over thing. My mom ignored me, literally. I tried everything I could to please her and get her to see me, but she never did. She still doesn't. Lydia, 37. Ainsworth began to see consistent patterns in maternal behavior that produced relatively reliable responses in their infants and called these children insecurely attached. Within that grouping, she distinguished between those who were avoidantly attached and those who were ambivalently attached. Her student, Mary Main, later added a third category, disorganized attachment, which results from physical abuse and extreme neglect. These categories aren't the result of hard wiring, but of experience, and they influence the child's development in profound and lasting ways. The interactions between the infant and her mother shape the infant's developing brain and her ability to self-regulate and calm herself. It's a dyadic dance, as the responsive mother reads her child's cues, her facial expressions, her vocalizations, her movements, and gives her what she needs in the moment. The securely attached child has her needs reliably and regularly answered. She is comforted when she's afraid, held when she feels lonely, fed when she's hungry, soothed when she's overtired. given space when she needs to calm down, and feels safe enough to explore a room away from her mother's side. She seeks proximity when she needs it, but as she gets older, she also becomes confident in herself. Her mother is attuned to her, and she, in turn, will become attuned to the changes in her mother's expressions and gestures. This interaction.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?